Hello and welcome to Fly Fishing Tales. You know, I've always thought that the waters of the River Kennet and the River Dun in Hungerford, about 70 miles west of London, are some of our best kept fly fishing secrets, with sport just as good as some of their better known neighbours like the Test. These tranquil waterways which run through Berkshire into the River Thames feature heavily in fly fishing literature. Halford leased a long stretch of water in the late 1800s. John Waller Hills was a regular visitor here and wrote about a subspecies of trout only found on the Kennet, locally called a greenback, and now a much prized rarity. The history of Hungerford, the town, derives from John Agaunt, Duke of Lancaster, born in 1340, the third son of King Edward III. He gave important rights to the town, including to raise cattle and to hunt and fish over the common land. Still today, the commoners own the fishing rights, and each commoner, mainly those who own a property on the High Street, have free fishing on 3 days a week. The town and manor of Hungerford also let the fishing to a select group of rods from out of town, who pay handsomely for the privilege which helps to maintain these wonderful waters. The town describes the fishery like this: "We place great emphasis on traditional fly fishing in a gentlemanly manner, rather than modern catch as many as you can type approaches. For us, the surroundings and setting are as important as the amount of fish caught. We therefore manage our fishery in much the same way as the rest of our estate, with an emphasis on ecology, wildlife, history and tradition." The man behind the success of the fishery is riverkeeper Rob Starr. In 1998, as part of the original Fly Fishing Tales audio series, I sat down with him in one of the charming old wooden fishing huts and got him to tell me a little bit about his life on the Kennet and the Dun.
Certainly falling in is always an entertaining subject. We've had one or two here, which you wouldn't quite believe people would put themselves in situations. We had one very elderly gentleman walked upon a bridge which no one else would. It was a derelict bridge, falling to pieces. No reason to be on it at all. He managed to walk upon it. Consequently, it collapsed, and he was found sometime later by one of our other rods, up to just over his middle, in totally unable to move. And this is a man well in his 80s. I mean, it's quite incredible, really, because sort of a young person like myself wouldn't even contemplate going on it. It just looks so dangerous. So we had to remove that one. We've had another gentleman stuck with his leg through a hatch when he's fallen in off the bridge at the top end of a set of hatches. He's actually had to retrieve him. He was stuck with his leg completely through the hatch, not being able to move at all. And he'd gone completely under when he fell in. But he's a true gentleman, and when he actually emerged from the water, he still had his tweed hat in place, he still had his tie straight, all his clothing in place. The only thing that was amiss was the fact he was completely saturated where he'd been underwater. So that was quite entertaining.
If you were going to describe what this bit of river was good for, and how you should fish it, and what you should use, what would you say?
Well, this part of the Kennet, it's principally for brown trout. You fish for them with a dry fly. Later in the summer, you can use a nymph, if you so wish. It's historically been one of the premier rivers within the country for chalk stream fishing with a dry fly. That's what people have paid good money over several centuries now to do, is to come to Hungerford and to fish for brown trout. We do also have good stocks of grayling. The grayling are fished for in the autumn, which just gives a little add-on to the trout season for those who wish to. And principally here, that is all we have, is the trout and the grayling. We do have pike. They are treated solely as vermin, and however many you get rid of, there always seems to be one or two more that come along. If you go lower down the Kennet, it becomes more of a mixed fishery, really almost just off our bottom boundary. The makeup of the river obviously changes slightly, and you get a lot of coarse fish, again of excellent quality, and again people travel from all over the country to fish for them. There's specimen barbel, perch, chub, roach, pike. I mean, the Kennet produces specimen size fish of really all the species which live within it. It's a very rich river, and people, you know, have travelled. In the 50s and 60s, a lot of people came out of London to fish the lower reaches of the Kennet for the coarse fish. People have always travelled to the upper, middle and upper reaches of the Kennet to fish for the trout. Again, they have been of a large, they've always been known for their large size and quality, and large average size as well. I mean, in pre-stocking days, people, there are records of, you know, trout averaging 2 pounds, which for a wild fishery is quite exceptional. It's a very gentle river, it's a very pleasant river to fish. You seem to be able to sort of get very close to the river. One or two of the larger chalk streams in their lower reaches almost don't feel like you should be wielding a fly rod, whereas the Kennet definitely, it has this lovely mixture of its trout and grayling in its upper reaches, and the grayling were an introduction at the end of the last century from the Avon, but it's a lovely, quiet, gentle balance in its upper reaches, and then it middle reaches and lower reaches is a nice little swap over between coarse fisheries and trout fisheries. There's a balance where some of the trout fisheries are fished for coarse fish in the winter, so both coarse and game anglers can enjoy those pieces, and then you get a little bit lower down again and you get it's solely coarse fish then, and occasionally someone catches a very large old trout that's found his way down there. And now with the Thames Salmon Trust very active in their work, we do have one or two salmon migrating now into the lower reaches of the Kennet, and the Kennet is going to be looked upon as one of their premier spawning sites. So there are now a reasonable number of salmon coming back up the Thames, and some of those are finding their way into the lower Kennet, and one or two are caught by coarse anglers each year accidentally. So it remains to be seen how far up they come. I don't think they'll get as far as we are now, but it does give leverage on environmental grounds if we get one or two slightly up towards us. There is a bit more pressure can be put on PLCs and others to keep the river clean. I think that's about all the good they'll do us up here.
Just say a little bit about fishing for trout then, and what you need, what you ought to bear in mind and how to go about it. A little bit of a lesson on fishing around here.
Fishing for trout, I've heard it said that what you require to be a good trout fisherman is first of all to have stealth, secondly to have more stealth, and thirdly to be in possession of even more stealth, and if you bear that in mind you'll do quite well. You need very little equipment for trout fishing. Literally, you could fish all season here with half a dozen flies and 2, maybe 3 small nymphs. You will need no more. But that's not what a lot of people wish to do when they are angling. Angling is a hobby, it is a pastime. They gain enjoyment from it, and buying lots of the very nice bits and pieces which are now available is all part of it. And I mean, some people have bags and bags of equipment, but really you need a very simple rod, just a rod that suits you. It can be a 50 pound rod or a 500 pound rod. The main thing is that it suits your style of casting, and if it does, that you can ask no more. So you want one rod, one reel, one line and a box of flies, and that is all you really need. If you want to keep your fish, and it helps to have a landing net as well. On all stretches of the Kennet, you fish in an upstream manner, which means you must fish, you must start at the bottom of your beat, working your way upstream and casting upstream from your standing position. If a fly is below you, you must lift off. And it's done like that so that A, you don't walk downstream and disturb someone who's walking up. Now, if you walk downstream, you're obviously scared of fish because they can see you coming. By walking upstream, you stealth comes in, you're creeping up on them. And also it's to stop the sort of the salmon angler side of things, where you, or the wet fly fishing, where you speculatively cast downstream and swing your flies round and search the water for a fish. What we do is we try and identify a fish principally by the fact it's rising and it's breaking the surface, taking flies. Then observe where it is. Do you want to fish for it in that position, don't you? If you can, get a look at the fish to see if it's a takeable fish. If not, you can judge its size to a degree by the actual ring it makes when it rises. A small fish will have very narrow little ripples. It's like throwing a little stone into a pool, a pebble. A large fish, when it comes up and sucks a fly in, you'll get a very large, gentle wave move out from the fish, where it's, not only has its nose come up, but its back, as it's come near the surface, has moved an amount of water. So you can always tell when a large fish is sipping flies in. So what we try and do is initially find a fish, decide if it's a worthy quarry. From that point, you get yourself into a position where you can fish for the fish. If you're going to do it exactly properly, then what you'll do is try and identify what it's taking and put on a fly which will match the natural fly which is coming down the river. A lot of people don't take the fishing to that extreme. A lot of times I certainly don't. I will cast really a selection of well-trusted flies. And I always feel that if you get your first cast in the right place, about a yard to 2 yards above the fish normally, without scaring it and without arousing any suspicion, the trout will take it. They are opportunists when they feed. You can flick all sorts of things at them when you're not actually fishing, things as bizarre as alderberries, and they will just come and take them. They'll take them once just to see what it is. You flick a worm in, they'll take it. You could flick a minnow out there, they would take it. I've seen people flick cigarette butts into the river, they come and take them. It's not saying all trout will be that naive, but certainly they do feed throughout the water column. And if something comes down, I mean, you often watch them in the autumn taking leaves. They just take things to see if it's edible. If it's not edible, they discharge it. So along those lines, you can really say that as long as you don't alert your quarry to your presence and can present the fly accurately, the first cast you stand a very good chance of probably taking 95% of fish within the river. Then you do occasionally find fish which are very selective, which there's a good hatch of fly taking place and they're taking one particular insect, but it's not a common occurrence. It does happen. You do need to bear it in mind, but for the majority of the fishing, I don't think you need to worry about being quite so exact in your manner. It's just really use some field craft. Field craft makes up for all the sins under the sun. Buying thousands of pounds worth of tackle will never make up for childhood learnt field craft. there is no comparison.
Is there a story of a particular fish that you've hunted down and was a bit trickier than the rest and you had to use different flies?
Most of my fishing now, I don't spend the time fishing, which a lot of people might think I would, being in the position that I am. What I tend to do is I either fish when I go to a different fishery, then I enjoy fishing and searching the water and having a nice look round. Or if I fish here, it tends to be when there has been a fish which has normally been lying in an obvious position. So a lot of rods have seen the fish. And if it's been there for, say, 5, 6 weeks, 2 months, and lying in a particular light, and often rising consistently, taking sort of small flies off the poplars in the summer, and small midge flies, and just continuing to rise whilst people fish for it, but ignoring them, then I always feel that you've got a educated fish there then. And every now and then I find I get the urge to sort of just to sort out what he's doing and to say, right, I'm going to spend half an hour and I'm going to catch you, you devil, to prove you that you're not quite as clever as you may think.
Tell us about one, then.
One was a fish that was rising, had been rising for some time early in the season above a footbridge, above the upstream stanchion on a footbridge. Now, you could certainly get to it from standing at the bridge, but you made yourself rather obvious, and a lot of people had done that. And of course, it could, you know, as soon as you get in position to cast, it is aware of your presence and can certainly see you. The only way to get to it without being seen and alerting it was to cast from below the bridge, under the bridge, which is about 6 feet wide, and upstream of the stanchion, which doesn't sound too difficult in itself, apart from the fact there's only about 10 inches of clear air between the water and the bottom of the bridge. So you have to cast the line parallel with the water surface, and not only keep the line parallel, which isn't too difficult, but to keep the fly also just skating the surface, and then to be able to cast a whole lot under the bridge and sort of shoot your line forward, get the fly and the tippet to turn over, and get it in front of the trout.
Tell us a little bit about, before you go on, finish the story off, but tell us a little bit about the rod you're using, line you're using, fly you're using, those sorts of considerations.
I had just a standard 4 to 5 weight fly rod, which is quite a, it's a medium to lightweight rod for here. A double tapered line, which is a classic line for presenting a dry fly delicately. And about a 9-10 foot leader of fine nylon, tapered fine nylon. Nothing complicated in itself. People may have wished to have a what you call a weight forward line to be able to shoot it under the bridge a little easier. But I didn't use one of those. I don't very often use one. I don't consider it necessary here. But it's just a standard line. Nice classical action rod. Nothing fancy. Nothing built for casting distances. Just something to enjoy fishing with.
Tell us about your thoughts about the fly to use and things like that. What went through your mind there?
Well, the fly I used on that occasion, it was quite simple. It was a small sedge pattern. Nothing complicated. It had a little bit of elk hair as a wing, and a little bit of seals fur dubbed on as a body. Greyish brown in colour, medium-sized sedge. And the reason I used for that, because the fish had been fished for so much, I thought the only way you're going to get a very good shot at it is to fish for it this time of night, nice and late, light starting to go, fish gains his confidence, and you can stalk them that much better. Not to say you can judge your casting under the bridge that much better. Luckily for me, the fish was obviously feeding very well, and it took about a dozen casts to actually get to grips with being able to put the fly under the bridge. So the first few fell short, a couple hit the bridge, and eventually I got, after a dozen, 15 casts, I got one cast right under the bridge and out in front of the fish, at which point he turned beautifully and took the fly. I couldn't believe my luck, struck and totally missed the fish. Didn't even touch him. So there's only one thing to do, is to sit quietly, hope he comes back on the feed and try again, and good as gold he did. Within 5 minutes he was feeding again. Again I managed to execute rather complicated little cast under the bridge, and again he came up good as gold and took it. At that point I caught the fish. He luckily came back under the bridge when I hooked him rather than go the other side of the stanchion. Not a tremendous fight. I got him to the edge and released him. It was only a small fish, a brown of perhaps 1.75 pounds, but because of where he was lying and the fact that he had seen a tremendous amount of fishermen, it made him a particularly satisfying fish to actually catch, when many people had been muttering for weeks that no one would ever catch the fish. So when that kind of challenge is thrown down, you have to occasionally discreetly take a rod and prove them wrong, whether it be with witnesses or without. And on that occasion, one of our elderly rods was watching me and was most impressed and didn't think he'd ever see another trout taken like it. But fortunately, I mean, I didn't even have to change a fly. The fish, you know, he hadn't been disturbed and he took the first fly that was offered him. And I think in a lot of cases, you will find that is the case. You don't need to be too complicated with them. They haven't got great, huge brains to go into the physics of the fishing tackle world. So just keep it simple and you can be okay. But we've had a number of fish like that over the last few years, which have been in... It always tends to be they're either fish that are very obvious or fish which are in particularly difficult places. Those are the ones which I really find enjoyable now. If I go to a new fishery, then obviously the initial enjoyment is just catching a fish. You've got to get one. You've got to start somewhere. And then you move on from that. But it tends to be very much for the pleasure of where you're fishing, how you're fishing, rather than just hauling fish out. They're not too difficult to catch. There's not too great a mystery involved in it. Brown, is it?
Oh, yes, pretty little brown trout.
Okay. Rob Starr, river keeper of the waters owned by the Hungerford Commoners, thanks to John O'Gaunt. You can inquire about fishing there through their website, but that's it for this edition of Fly Fishing Tales. Until the next time, goodbye.